opportunity of welcoming the National Prosecution Authority. Welcome to you, Advocate Sean Abrams, the National Director for Public Prosecution. We will be expecting from you this afternoon a presentation of your annual report, and you will then therefore decide as to how to handle the presentation. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chairperson, members of the committee, my colleagues from the NPA, members of the media that are present, ladies and gentlemen. Chairperson, let me briefly just introduce my team to you. On my far right is Advocate Nomvula Mokatla, who is a Deputy National Director of Public Prosecution and who heads the Asset Forfeiture Unit. On my immediate right is Dr. Silas Ramahiti, who is a Deputy National Director of Public Prosecutions and who heads the administration of the institution, so he's directly in my office. On my left is Advocate Sibongile Mzanyati, on my immediate left. He's an acting Deputy National Director of Public Prosecution. You know, he's acting in the position of Advocate Nomobo Jiba, who's still on special leave. On his left is Advocate Marlene Govender, who's an acting special director who heads the SCTU, the Specialized Commercial Crime Unit, and she acts in that position in place of Advocate Lawrence Mruebi, who is still on special leave. Directly next to her is Ms. Salome Baloy, who heads my strategy and risk in the institution. We then have Bulawa Makeke directly next to her, who is the head of communications in the NPA. Then we have Hanika van Zyl, who is the head of finance in the NPA, and directly next to her, right at the end, is Advocate Knox Molele, who is an acting special director and heads the operation of the Asset Forfeiture Unit. Chairperson, we have the honor of presenting the National Prosecuting Authority's annual performance report for the period 2016 to 2017 as envisaged by the provisions of Section 35, Subsection 2A, read with Section 22, Subsection 4G of the National Prosecuting Authority Act. Our performance, whether same amounts to over or under achievements, are reported openly and transparently. We welcome and respect the very necessary oversight powers of this committee, and we acknowledge the benefit of our engagement with the committee in improving service delivery and in building confidence in the administration of justice, and more particularly confidence in the National Prosecuting Authority, the application of the rule of law, and transparency. The National Prosecuting Authority sub-program 4 of the Department of Justice. We remain committed to the realization of the goals set by the government through the National Development Plan and in giving effect to the long-term vision of the Justice Crime Prevention and Security Cluster Delivery Agreement by ensuring that all people in South Africa are safe and feel safe. In this regard, we provide a coordinated prosecuting service that ensures that justice is delivered to the victims of crime through general and specialized prosecutions, that profit is removed from crime, and that witnesses and the related persons are protected. I'd like to refer you to slide 6, where we say that the NPA contributes to the achievement of the following outcomes of the medium-term strategic framework which are also contained in the JCPS delivery agreement. Outcome one being reduced level of contact crime. Outcome two, an efficient and effective criminal justice system. Outcome four, securing cyberspace. Outcome five, ensuring domestic stability. And outcome seven, reducing corruption in the public and private sectors. I'd like to refer you to slide nine, where we discuss our strategic objectives. We have three strategic objectives: increase successful prosecutions, secondly, ensuring that profit is removed from crime, and thirdly, to ensure that threatened witnesses and related persons are successfully protected. Can we move to slide 10? We have four sub-programs, namely the National Prosecution Services, the Asset Forfeiture Unit, the Office for Witness Protection, and Support Services, which is administration. The National Prosecuting Service is further categorized into General Prosecutions, the Specialized Commercial Crime Unit, the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit, and the Sexual Offenses and Community Affairs Unit. The NPA places great reliance on support from key stakeholders in the criminal justice system, especially the police and the judiciary. Although we are one of the critical pillars in the criminal justice system value chain, our performance is intrinsically linked to the support and efficiency of our key stakeholders, in particular the South African Police Service, the Directorate for Priority Crimes Investigation, the Judiciary, the Department of Justice and Correctional Services, Legal Aid South Africa, the attorneys and advocates professions. We also work very closely with other stakeholders in the justice, crime prevention and security cluster. These inter alia include the Special Investigative Unit, the South African Revenue Service, the Financial Intelligence Center, the State Security Agency, the Reserve Bank, the Department of Public Service and Administration, the Department of Home Affairs, the Public Protector's Office, the Competition Commission, the Department of Planning and Monitoring in the Presidency, and the Independent Police Investigating Directorate, known as the IPID. To this end, Chairperson, successful prosecutions largely depend on the ability to have investigations concluded, having obtained the relevant, reliable, and admissible evidence, and presenting same before a court. We at the NPA continue to be presented at the Forum of Heads of Entities, convened by the Director General of Justice and Constitutional Development, to ensure effective delivery in the criminal justice system. The ability to ensure that trial-ready cases proceed timelessly, however, remains a constant challenge. The placing of too few cases on the court floor for trial result in the inability to optimally utilize court hours. This hampers performance. As will be seen on slide 19, it is rather regrettable that the average criminal court hours significantly decreased year on year from 3 hours 34 minutes during 2010 to 2011 to 3 hours and 16 minutes during 2015 and 16, and a little further to 3 hours and 13 minutes during the reporting period of 2016 to 2017. The district court utilization of court hours decreased by 4 minutes from 3 hours 13 minutes during the last reporting period to 3 hours and 9 minutes during the current reporting period. Similarly, the regional court's utilization of court hours also decreased by 4 minutes from 3 hours and 26 minutes during 2015 to 16 to 3 hours and 22 minutes during 2016 to 2017. While the High Court's utilization of court hours increased by 8 minutes from 2 hours 48 minutes during 2015 to 16 to 2 hours and 56 minutes during the current reporting period. We accept that the utilization of court hours is not enough and does not instill confidence in the administration of justice. This is also a substantial deviation from that set by the Chief Justice's norms and standards, which requires all courts to sit for a minimum of 4 hours and 30 minutes per day. A number of factors cumulatively impacting on the ability of all stakeholders contribute to the inability to meet this set requirement. The reality, Chairperson, is that the norms and standards issued by the Chief Justice, and which vest the responsibility of determining the number of cases placed in the court rolls daily, has to date not yielded the envisaged increase in the utilization of court hours, which impacts on the finalization of cases. Can we move on to slide 12, please? We continue to participate at quarterly provincial efficiency enhancement committee meetings chaired by the respective judge presidents and the national efficiency enhancement committee meeting, which is ordinarily chaired by the chief justice, to inter alia improve on giving effect to the norms and standards as issued by the chief justice and to improve on challenges around case flow management and in endeavors to alleviate the many operational challenges. The implementation of pre-trial hearings has been identified as a solution to minimize the remand of trial-ready cases. During our last appearance before this committee on 6 September 2017, we alluded to the criminal practice directives for the regional courts issued by the Regional Court Presidents Forum that came into effect on 1 September this year. These are in line with the norms and standards and aim to improve uniformity, promote best practice, improve the efficiency and effectiveness of court and case law management, and to eliminate the unnecessary and or unreasonable delays in court proceedings and provide for mandatory pre-trial hearings. Although I am advised that pre-trial hearings have become practice in respect of high court criminal matters in all jurisdictions, most recently at the last NEEC meeting on 28 September 2017, I committed to establishing a team which would work closely with the judiciary and the Office of the Chief Justice to craft draft pre-trial directives in relation to high court criminal matters in the interest of uniformity and to improve efficiency in court and case flow management. Chairperson, there has also been key collaboration between the National Prosecuting Authority and the South African Police Service. In this regard, and more specifically, post this reporting period, there have been bilateral engagements between the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services and the Minister of Police to enhance cooperation between the entities under the responsibilities of the two ministries. These initiatives has yielded critical engagements between the respective entities, which are inter alia looking at joint training initiatives and programs, joint target setting, the reviewing, finalizing, and signing of the screening protocol between the Department of Justice, the police, and the National Prosecuting Authority, joint initiatives to combat various topical crime typologies and various other aspects impacting on the criminal justice system in enhancing service delivery and efficiency. We are extremely optimistic to favorably report back to this committee on these joint initiatives with our key stakeholders, either quarterly when invited to appear before this committee or during the presentation of our 2017 to 2018 annual performance report a year from now. Chairperson, the scourge of both private and public sector corruption, the increase in violent protests and industrial action, the continuous threat posed by gangsterism, the unending substance abuse and trade in illicit substances, the unlawful possession of unlicensed firearms and ammunition, the continued threat of cybercrime in all sectors, investigations into money laundering, terror financing, and illicit financial flows can only be overcome by a collective effort of all stakeholders, including the community, who remain our eyes and ears. In enhancing close collaboration with stakeholders, the NPA also participates in the Anti-Corruption Task Team, chaired by the head of the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation, and which also includes the SIU, the FIC, SARS, State Security Agency, NICOC, which is the National Intelligence Coordinating Committee, and other key stakeholders such as the DPSA, the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation in the Presidency, and of course the Department of Justice. The ACTT was established to fast-track investigations and prosecutions of serious corruption cases. In this regard, the NPA was instrumental in the crafting of the ACTT strategic plan and its terms of reference. The NPA has also contributed in the compilation of the government anti-corruption discussion document requiring a whole governmental and societal approach in the fight against corruption. Yesterday, the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, when he appeared before this committee, called for a collaborative whole-of-societal and political mindset in addressing the scourge of corruption during his political overview. By way of example, Chairperson, Hong Kong is one of the most efficient corruption-combating success stories. It, however, took them 40 years to enjoy the successes they enjoy today. Having adopted a whole-of-societal approach in their fight against corruption. Remember, the many government officials accused of corruption cannot be corrupt on their own. Private individuals and entities are equally culpable. There must be accountability at all levels, both in the private sector and within government. The NPA represents government internationally as part of the South African delegation at the Financial Action Task Force and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is known as the OECD. The FATF is an intergovernmental body which sets standards and promotes the effective implementation of legal, regulatory and operational measures for combating money laundering, terror financing and the financing of proliferation and other related threats to the integrity of the international financial system. On the other hand, the OECD Working Group on Bribery in International Business Transactions is responsible for monitoring the implementation and enforcement of the OECD Anti-Bribery Convention, its subsequent recommendations and related instruments. It further establishes legally binding standards to criminalize bribery of foreign public officials in international business transactions. As we reported to this committee during September 2017, budgetary constraints resulted in vacant posts not being filled, placing severe strain on the NPA staff establishment. This has affected the aspirant prosecutors program, which is critical in sustaining the organization's professional staff component. If necessary, Dr. Ramaiti, Advocate Mzinyati, and Ms. Van Zyl will elaborate more thereon later. This committee has, however, acknowledged our plight and the impact it has had and will continue to have on this critical institution. In this regard, during September 2017, this committee pledged its support for the NPA for additional funds, which we are extremely grateful for, Chairperson. We have embarked on a process of optimizing the utilization of professional resources. This process has commenced in the head office in Pretoria. An internal work audit yielded results which determined that some persons were in excess in the VGM building in their respective business units. These persons have been informed and are in the process of being reassigned to offices that require resources and where their skills are much needed. This process of optimum utilization of resources will be rolled out to the asset forfeiture unit and the administrative component at head office, as well as to each director of public prosecution office in the region and specialist prosecution units in the region. My office is also in the process of concluding an urgent meeting in relation to our budgetary constraints for warm bodies with the Director General of the Department of Treasury, with whom I have already had a telephonic discussion on our challenges and the associated urgency. I'd like us to go to slide 13. The NPA is audited as Program 4 under the Department of Justice and Correctional Services. Overall, the Auditor General expressed an unqualified audit opinion on the NPA. There was, however, a single material finding in respect of specific adjustments made by the Asset Forfeiture Unit in respect of its indicators. This was confirmed by the Auditor General during yesterday's briefing to this committee. We have mitigated against this risk being repeated. Timeous audit action plans are in place to ensure that management implements corrective measures to circumvent a repeat finding. We have progressed significantly to achieving 88% of our targets. This is the best performance the NPA has achieved since its inception on 16 October 1998. This has, however, been at a great cost, Chairperson. As a direct result of the resource constraints, this has placed a considerable extra burden on the other staff. This has resulted in an increase in the use of employment wellness program, and it has affected the staff generally. Notwithstanding our constraints, we've achieved tremendously well. We acknowledge at the outset there are numerous areas that we can, must, and will continue to strive to improve on. High conviction rates were maintained in all forums. A conviction rate of 91% was achieved in the High Courts against a target of 87%, with 1,064 cases being finalized in which guilty verdicts were obtained in 968 cases, acquittals in 96, and with 61 withdrawals in the High Court. This is the highest conviction rate in respect of High Court matters since the creation of the NPA. Interestingly, the number of bail applications in the High Courts have increased significantly by approximately 115% from 26 to 56. The High Courts, of course, are not courts of first instance when it comes to bail applications, and the Criminal Procedure Act ordinarily provides for bail applications to be heard in the lower courts. The lower courts are courts of first instance in relation to bail applications. Now, the phenomenon of the increase of bail applications in the High Courts can largely be attributed to instances where matters have been transferred from the regional court to the High Courts and accused bringing applications on new facts. A typical example hereof is a successful bail application in a High Court on new facts brought by the accused in the well-known Coffin case weeks before their trial. They were subsequently convicted by the High Court weeks later. At the last NEC meeting on the 26th of September, I pledged my support to the heads of court to pursue legislative reform where all bail applications should be held in the lower courts, and for regional court magistrates to conduct bail applications after hours on an urgent basis instead of the High Court being approached in this regard. The Director of Public Prosecution Offices also received 17,921 decision dockets compared to the 15,459 the previous year. On slide 16, we look at the statistics of the regional courts, which reflect a conviction rate of 80%, 79.8%, if we round it off to becomes 80%. This was achieved against a target of 74%. Again, this is the highest conviction rate in this forum since the creation of the NPA. Although the courts finalized 34,257 cases, formal bail applications, which increased from 3,476 the previous year to 4,428, utilized most of the court time. 119,234 police dockets were received, which is 14,649 more than the previous year. In respect of 18,940 dockets, prosecutions were instituted, whilst the NPA declined to prosecute in respect of 43,298 dockets. 57,270 dockets were referred back for further investigation to the police before a final decision could be made as to whether a prosecution should be instituted or not. The regional courts also withdrew 10,721 cases compared to the 12,228 the previous year, signifying the enhancement of proper screening processes in the National Prosecuting Authority, as reflected in slide 20. Can we move to slide 17, please? I'd like to discuss the district court statistics. A conviction rate of 96% was achieved in the district courts. Again, this is the highest success rate in this forum ever. The district courts enrolled 827,599 new cases, 20,630 more than the previous year. 777,196 dockets were received for decision, 36,263 more than the previous year. The NPA declined to prosecute in 430,363 of these. In 253,710 dockets, we referred these matters back for further investigation, and in 91,687 dockets, prosecutions were instituted. 90,104 cases were withdrawn in the district courts. That can be found in slide 20. And this is, of course, in comparison to the 95,119 cases withdrawn the previous year. Again, this signifies the enhancement of screen procedures in the National Prosecuting Authority at District Level 2. Can we move to slide 21, please? In respect of organized crime matters, a conviction rate of 90% was maintained, compared to 88.9% the previous year. 368 cases were finalized compared to 359 the previous year. Although we are yet to break the camel's back in respect of gang violence, the NPA concluded 28 gang-related violence matters, of which there were 26 convictions and 2 acquittals, recording an outstanding 93% success rate. Again, I didn't intend for gang language such as 28 and 26 to feature in these statistics. The NPA finalized 39 cases in relation to rhino poaching, obtaining 38 convictions. In respect of environmental crimes, we obtained a conviction rate of 94.5% with 363 convictions, which are 6 more than the previous year. Our focus on copper theft resulted in a remarkable 91.8% success rate with 234 convictions, which is 43 more than the previous year. Can we move to slide 22, please? We obtained a conviction rate of 71.7%, being the highest success rate ever recorded in respect of sexual offences in the general prosecutions. This, of course, is in giving effect to our commitment to the most vulnerable members of our society, namely women and children. In respect of matters reported at Tutazela care centres, this can be found on slide 25. We achieved a conviction rate of 71%. This is 1% less than the previous year. Again, Chairperson, nothing really turns on this, as it only signifies 6 cases less than the previous year. This is still right up there with the best success rate ever achieved in respect of matters reported to the TCCs, which was last year. We must, however, emphasize that 32,239 matters were reported to the 55 nationwide TCC centers during the past year. Can we return to slide 22, please? In respect of trio crimes, a conviction rate of 83.5% was achieved against a target of 85%. Chairperson, we concede that we did not do as well as we would have liked in respect of this target. It is, however, a slight deviation of 1.5%. In comparison to last year, we did, however, do much better in that we obtained convictions in respect of 1,552 matters during this reporting period compared to the 1,391 during the last reporting period. An 83% success rate is recorded in respect of house robberies and 89% in respect of business robberies, while in respect of vehicle robberies, which we commonly refer to as hijacking, our success rate is recorded at 76%. This, of course, does remain a challenge for us. Can we move to slide 23, please? In respect of violent protests and industrial actions, a conviction rate of 56% was achieved against a target of 74%. We acknowledge at the onset that this does not reflect well. During our last engagement with this committee in September, we recorded that these matters are somewhat intricate and have inherent challenges, as witnesses are reluctant to testify, the identification of perpetrators, and the notable significant discrepancies between witnesses' evidence insofar as their statements are concerned and as established during consultations remain a massive challenge for law enforcement. Can we go to slide 23, please? Chairperson, a conviction rate of 92% was achieved in respect of complex commercial crime cases against a target of 93%. You recall that during the previous reporting period, we had achieved a remarkable 94%. Advocate Govender will later on explain the 2% deviation from last year's best ever recorded achievement. A conviction rate of 97% was achieved in respect of cybercrime prosecutions against a target of 74%. This is a significant improvement from last year, where 244 cases were recorded as opposed to the 289 cases during this reporting period. Now, 29 people were convicted against a target of 25 in respect of the number of persons convicted of corruption or offences related to corruption, where the amount involved is in excess of 5 million rand. We acknowledge, Chairperson, that this should improve significantly going forward in light of the collective endeavours to fight the scourge of corruption. We also achieved our target in respect of the number of government officials convicted for corruption or offences related to corruption, successfully prosecuting 224 people, significantly more than the 206 which was recorded during the previous reporting period. Can we move to slide 26, please? Chairperson, the asset forfeiture unit, I am advised, achieved its best performance in the last 5 years. We do, however, acknowledge that there is still plenty more room to do even better. The asset forfeiture unit completed 572 forfeiture cases with a value of 424.6 million. This is significantly better than the 389 finalized cases with a value of 349.5 million recorded during the previous reporting period. The number of freezing orders is recorded at 377 and valued at 1.194 billion compared to the 326 orders valued at 778.9 million recorded during the last reporting period. Again, this is a significant achievement by the Asset Forfeiture Unit. The Asset Forfeiture Unit also achieved its target in relation to the value of freezing orders relating to corruption, where the amount involved is more than 5 million rand, attaining 627.3 million rand compared to the 238.6 million rand recorded during the previous reporting period. The target in respect of the value of recoveries in terms of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act was also achieved, recovering 219 million rand against a target of 170 million rand. The AFU also finalized 554 out of 560 cases in respect of which it litigated in. Can we move to slide 29, please? The Office for Witness Protection achieved both its targets. No witnesses or related persons were harmed, threatened or killed whilst on the witness protection program. The OWP has achieved this successfully and in the last 15 years. There were 228 new admissions into the witness protection program. The amount of witnesses in the program is now sitting at 404. Of these, 262 witnesses attended judicial proceedings during the reporting period. 28 accused were convicted. Out of these, 308 prison terms were imposed by the courts, and in 8 of these, there were life imprisonment sentences imposed. Can we go to slide 31, please? 1,383 civil claims were received during this period compared to the 1,109 the previous period. 256 applications were received compared to the 251 the previous reporting period. 64 agreements were vetted compared to the 15 during the previous period. Can we go to slide 32, please? 24 applications for centralization of cases were authorized by me during the reporting period. 15 racketeering applications were also received by me, of which I approved 13 and declined the applications in respect of the remaining two. 571 files pertaining to representations in respect of general prosecutions were received. This is more than the 521 representations that were received in the previous reporting period. Out of these, 127 were placed before me for review. In addition to these matters, a further 69 matters were placed before me for review. Out of the 69 matters, I confirmed the decisions in 61, and I overturned the decisions in respect of 8 of these. I'm happy to go back and look at the 127 that were referred to me and to provide the statistics in respect of how many I agreed with and how many decisions I overturned. 104 new requests for mutual legal assistance were received. Of these, 61 were finalized. There were also 46 requests for extraditions. 21 of these have been concluded. I've also entered into memorandum of understanding with the Office of the Prosecutor General of the Russian Federation and the Office of the Prosecutor General of the Arab Republic of Egypt. Of course, more recently, I've entered into a number of other memorandum of understanding, but I'll speak more about that when I next appear before this committee. The NPA participated in the 8th Conference of the State Parties to the United Nations Convention against Transnational Organized Crime, as well as in the 5th session of the Working Group on the International Cooperation in Vienna and Austria. The NPA was the joint lead examiner in the 4th phase evaluation of the United Kingdom's compliance with the OECD requirements on foreign bribery. The NPA also serves as the co-chair of the Asset Recovery Initiative Network of South Africa, which is commonly referred to as ARINZA. I serve as the Treasurer General of the Africa Prosecutors Association, and I sit on its executive committee. Two of my senior members of the NPA, Advocate Mzinyati and Advocate Toli Kanyile, serve as strategic committee members. Advocate Kanyele is the Director of Public Prosecutions in the Free State. I attended the International Association of Prosecutors Conference in Dublin, Ireland, during the reporting period, and I presented a paper at the opening plenary titled The Relationship Between the Investigator and the Prosecutor. I led a delegation of a number of officials from the NPA to attend this conference. Three members of the delegation received an award for the best prosecutor of the year in respect of a gang-related matter, organized crime matter that they conducted. The three prosecutors are here from the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution in the Western Cape. One of the members of the team, the lead prosecutor, has since retired. I'm also a member of the BRICS Heads of the Prosecution Agencies and led a delegation to the meeting of the BRICS Heads of Prosecution in Sanya, the People's Republic of China, where I presented a paper on fighting corruption to ensure sustainable economic and social development. Again, I led a delegation of members of the NPA to that engagement. Side issues that were discussed related to counterterrorism as well. The draft accountability structure, which I spoke about during my last appearance before this committee, and as envisioned in Section 22, Subsection 5 of the National Prosecuting Authority Act, has been submitted to me, and I intend consulting the Minister hereon. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel in bringing finality to this accountability structure. In his foreword in our report, the Minister of Justice mentions that the NPA is presently engaging with the Department of Justice on whether it should be an entity within the department or an independent entity with its own budget. The position currently is the National Prosecuting Authority Act provides for the Director General of Justice as the accounting officer. We are, of course, Program 4. We are in the final stages of making a submission to the Minister for the NPA to be a complete independent entity. We, of course, are independent. The issue of independence here relates to financial independence insofar as the institution is concerned. This will, of course, require amendments to the National Prosecuting Authority Act. So any submissions we make in that regard will serve before this committee in due course. During my last appearance before this committee, we did speak about awaiting trial detainees. Of course, we meet regularly with other stakeholders in the criminal justice system on a monthly basis to alleviate the plight of awaiting trial detainees. In this regard, we need to move to a position where an accused, at his or her next appearance, after having granted bail, especially so if the amount of bail is 500 or less than 1,000 rand, that the investigating officer is in a position to inform the prosecutor who could address the court on the position of the accused. And of course, there's a responsibility on judicial officers to play a more an inquisitorial role in respect of bail applications. And it will be important for presiding officers to revisit the position of accused persons at the second appearance where bail has been granted. I think this will go a long way to alleviating the plight of awaiting trial detainees. This is an issue that I addressed in similar vein at the last NEEC meeting about a week ago. One of the issues that was raised at the NEC meeting is the issue of early arrest or premature arrest by the South African police services. Of course, this ultimately results in high withdrawal rates, at a later stage. Of course, the issue was, why can't the police investigate matters until completion, before matters are brought to court? And where police are well aware that an accused is not a flight risk and that accused will not evade justice, why is there a necessity to affect and arrest an accused? Because there are other means of securing the attendance of an accused at court. Of course, these are issues that we will engage our stakeholders on during our close collaboration in enhancing the administration of justice and the processes associated therewith. During my last appearance before this committee, I spoke about topical cases. I spoke about the eight legs of the state of capture report of Thuli Madonsela. I spoke of PRASA. We spoke about the police, the IPER investigation into procurement in the South African Police Services, in which the former Acting National Commissioner of Police, General Pashlani, is allegedly implicated. I spoke about Marikana. I spoke about Nkandla. I'm not going to speak about it again today. I did take this committee into my confidence less than a month ago. I'd like to once again thank this committee for its guidance and its oversight responsibilities, and I look forward to my engagement with this committee, whether it's on a quarterly basis or more regular, or whether it's on an annual basis. I'd like to hand over to Ms. Van Zyl, who would briefly speak on the budget and the MTEF. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Under budget performance for the previous financial year, the first slide I've got is our overall expenditure versus our budget. On this slide, you can see that we've broken even, yeah. So from the 2015-2016 financial year, as was already mentioned, we are part of the Department of Justice financial statements. So we didn't complete our own financial statements. We just gave inputs into the Department of Justice. We only published the high-level expenditure versus budget outcome in the report of the NDPP. The first slide in the presentation is the final budget versus expenditure. This is after we've done the environment in consultation with National Treasury. So this is the nice cleaned up picture. The next slide is the budget versus the expenditure before the environment. Here you can see how we move the money within our economic classification. On this slide you can see that we had to move 32 million to our compensation budget. So we didn't have sufficient compensation budget in the previous financial year. We have already alluded in the Q1 that we are facing a similar position in the current financial year and that we are anticipating a shortfall of 71 million in the current financial year. Now, in the previous financial year, this 32 million we moved from our operational budget, we moved 24 million to personnel and 13 million within the capital budget. We moved to compensation budget. This move is creating a scenario where our operational versus the compensation budget is a 85-50% ratio, which is not sustainable for the organization. We have to cut down on certain procurement projects. We can't continue with the normal operational cost because we need to fund our warm bodies. The next slide is just if we look only at our compensation situation, the 32 million that we moved last year, this is just to show that this is a historical problem that has came from 2015-16, where we already had a 14 million shortfall on our compensation budget. And this picture is just increasing and getting worse every year. If we look at our MTF budget allocation going forward, this is also a familiar slide that was already presented to this committee. It's just to show you the growth of the NPA's budget allocation, which is only 5% growth over the MTF period, and we only had a 3.56% budget growth in the current financial year. If we look at the 5% growth, average growth, against our CPIX of 6.6% in 2016-17, we really have to tighten all our procurement and our ways of doing business to make sure that we remain within our budget allocation. The next slide is that if we're not looking at the overall NPA budget allocation, this is only looking at the compensation growth. Here you can see that we've increased only 2% in the current financial year, our budget, and this is where our problem for our aspirant program that's already alluded by the MDPP that's going to face the NPA. We can't sustain our personnel numbers with our current budget allocation. And that's all from the budget side. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the presentation from the National Prosecution Authority. I'm now going to open to members' questions, comments, areas of concern. I'll recognize Honorable Horn, to be followed by Honorable Breitenbach, Honorable Swart, Honorable Motapo, Honorable Matthias, Honorable Bumlwana, in that order.
Thanks, Madam Acting Chair, and thank you for the presentation. There's a few issues I would like to raise in respect of both the financials as well as other aspects of the report. First of all, in respect of the budget shortfall, Madam Acting Chair, this is obviously indeed the opportune time for us to try and assist the National Prosecuting Authority. If we can at this stage maybe be apprised as to whether any, I don't want to say interim, but measures have already been taken at this stage to capacitate the offices in Mpumalanga and Limpopo, in which we previously were informed there is no money available to make the necessary high-level appointments that could assist. Also for us ultimately in terms of the BRRR reports to make any additional recommendations. Then also in respect of the vacancies at the Serious Economical Crimes Unit, previously it was reported that due to this moratorium on the filling of vacancies, they will be finding it difficult to fill some of these vacancies. If we can be afforded information as to that, whether that is still the case, because obviously the Serious Economic Crimes Unit is of importance, as the National Director alluded to, the scourge of corruption and the fight against corruption. Then coming to the fight against corruption, Madam Chair, it would be good, it's now nearly a month later after we were apprised of the eight-legged investigation, as to whether there's any progress. Last time the National Director, I think, took us into his confidence that he didn't like South Africans on social media asking where he is, and he said he's there, he's working, maybe not in Hollywood style anymore, but he's working. So it would be good if we can hear on behalf of South Africans what's the progress on this matter. Maybe the middle ground will be best for Advocate Abrams to also maybe take South Africans into his confidence. Then also in respect of a court case reflecting ultimately on him, although it is a senior public prosecutor that was taken to task by the Supreme Court of Appeal in Van Heerden versus National Director of Public Prosecutions case, where the Supreme Court of Appeal on the 11th of September made some very negative remarks regarding the strategy and tactics, and whether he can appraise this committee as to what his reaction is to these findings and how a reoccurrence of this will be prevented going forward. Maybe just for the record, Madam Acting Chair, this was a prosecutor who apparently, in order to avoid a matter being struck from the roll, made certain remarks regarding only pursuing specific charges, but the court described the strategy as a ruse and ultimately said that this contributed to a situation where the accused was faced with an unfair trial. Then, Madam Acting Chair, in respect of the High Court conviction rate, which obviously is as the National Director said, something that is a positive and something to be proud of. The worry is just that there's another side to the coin, and that's that the withdrawal rate in the High Court is always has also been, I would think, maybe the highest ever, if not. And whether we must, if we read that together, maybe then question the conviction rate and what led to 13% of the cases in the High Court being withdrawn. And then lastly, two issues that's also been coming for a while. The first just maybe also in terms of our oversight, given the fact that the two members are still on special leave on the and being paid by the taxpayers, whether the National Director has any information as to when the appeal hearings of Ms. Mukhwebe and Ms. Jiba will be set down in the Supreme Court of Appeal. And then the very last matter is the charges against Mr. Richard Ndluli, which the Supreme Court of Appeal in March 2015 already ordered to be reinstated. Whether that has been re-enrolled, and if not, why not yet? It's more than 2 years later. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Honourable Breitenbach.
Thank you. Thank you for the report, and well done to Mr. Molele for his results. They're impressive. The Victims of Crime Survey 2017 by Stats SA reports a total of 1,468,278 crime incidents experienced by households in the 2016-2017 reporting period. The NPA reports a total of 915,928 decision dockets. This includes matters carried over from previous years. And the courts managed 321,166 convictions, which is described in your report as a remarkable 94.1% conviction rate. There's a serious discrepancy in these figures. Could you address that for me, please? The Victims of Crime Survey report also reports a 110% spike in sexual offences against a decrease in the number of matters reported to TCCs as compared to previous years. Can you tell us why this could be, please? The 2016-2017 report on the implementation of the Criminal Law, Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act reports that only 77% of adults and 80% of children received consultations by prosecutors before they testified, with some witnesses reporting that they saw the prosecutor for the first time while testifying in court. Can you discuss this for me, please, and tell me what steps can be put in place to rectify this problem, if you agree that it's a problem? How many cases has the ACTT dealt with in this reporting period? How many were prosecuted? And how many convictions were obtained? In your report, you referred to court hours having decreased to just 3 hours and 13 minutes. That's really alarming. What steps have been implemented to address this continuous dwindling of court hours, which should be way, way higher than that? The SIU reports that in 2015-2016, 307 matters were referred to the NPA, and in 2016-2017, 108 matters were referred to the NPA. What is the progress on these 415 matters? How many have been enrolled? How many finalized, and how many convictions obtained? IPED reports 508 cases referred between April and September 2016. Only 27 convictions were obtained. What is the reason for this big difference in these numbers?
Can you just repeat those numbers?
Sure. IPED reports 508 cases referred between April and September 2016. And only 27 convictions. If you don't have all the information at hand, it's fine to answer some of them in writing. What is the current position with regard to the fact that some senior state advocates currently earn more than the level 14 senior deputy directors? I'm sure that you're aware, as I am, that it's a cause of great unhappiness, distress, and many other issues. What is the position? What is being done about it? Why is it not being addressed? You will agree that it's untenable. The aspirant prosecutors program has been a casualty of the NPA financial constraints. While it is understandable that you have constraints, what steps are being put in place to address this issue? You have said that you wanted to set up an investigating directorate in terms of Section 28. But the DPCI would not agree. Is that correct? And if so, what steps have you taken to do so without the... You don't really need the agreement of the DPCI, so what are you doing about that issue? Have you yet received the docket from OUTA? They claim they have delivered it with their evidence. If you have received it, when did you receive it, and when do you propose to act upon it? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Breitenbach, Honourable Swart.
thank you, and thank you for the presentation from my side, and also to well done on the results under very difficult budgetary conditions. I really commend the NPA for that, and we need specifics when we're doing our report now as to how we can try to again assist financially, Chair. Just there are big asks, but this is a time now where we can try to motivate additional funding, because it's very difficult for us to hold you accountable if we're not giving you enough funds to do your work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to, maybe if you could give us just the most urgent needs that we can try and motivate again when we file our report now. That's what the budget review process is about. I also wanted to just then ask on a couple of the issues that are raised in the report. And the Specialized Commercial Crime Unit has a number of challenges, but it seems to relate more to the restructuring of the SAPs, and this is highlighted on page 40, where the Hawks now deal with projects and less cases, less commercial cases, and it seems that detectives are now doing commercial work, and you highlight how you are trying to assist with prosecutor-guided investigations. But surely this doesn't seem right to me, Chair, because surely we need to sit with SAPs and say, but why are you giving complex commercial matters to police station level detectives? Why are the Hawks not dealing with this? So maybe you could just unpack that a little bit, because it's obviously placing a lot of pressure on your prosecutors now that have to go and assist the detectives to do their work. And that will obviously improve your conviction rate. But if you've got a unit, why the Hawks I'm talking about, why are they not, what does it mean by projects? Are they, is it cherry picking or what? Because it's a bit of a concern that you raise on page 40. And I think you are commendably trying to resolve that issue. But we need to understand why that decision was taken to remove skilled detectives at doing the work at the Hawks level, and that's going down now to station level detectives who are not dedicated on commercial work. I also want to commend you on the human trafficking issue. I raised it in Parliament in a statement where the one particular prosecutor who had obtained 8 life sentences, you will know who it is, I can't remember her name now, but we mentioned that in Parliament as well, not in a speech but in a statement, where there was recently a judgment that came out that upheld those 8 life sentences for trafficking. And I think that is very, very commendable, that human traffickers need to know that South Africa, we've got very harsh legislation and it is being implemented, life sentences. Then an issue which relates to the state capture, and I know you gave us a briefing previously, but this morning we were advised by the department that whilst a double taxation agreement had been entered into with the United Arab Emirates that seems to benefit residents that leave South Africa and prevent SARS from pursuing criminal cases there due to this double taxation agreement, or even civil cases, there's no extradition agreement. And this seems to be ongoing with discussions, and it's to me very disturbing. Why was a double taxation agreement entered into which tax experts and even a government tax expert who anonymously said this goes against norms and standards, why was that entered into and no extradition agreement has been entered into? So I just wanted to ask you, what are the implications of not having an extradition agreement with United Arab Emirates? Should certain people implicated in the state capture reports leave the country, what recourse do you have? Are there other ways, firstly, we're looking at the criminal matters, but secondly, the recovery of funds that might have been illicitly moved? We know there was success recently with a well-known attorney, Bobrov, in Israel. Yeah, but there you would have to have had an agreement. Do you have a similar type of agreement? Maybe you can brief us on that, and that will be helpful to know. But thank you, and well done from our side.
Thanks, Honorable Swart, Honorable Mutapo.
You are not on the driving seat.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Honorable colleagues. Thank you, NPA, as a collective, because I think whatever you are doing as a collective under supervision of National Director of Public Prosecution. It will be naive of us to single out an individual when good has been done. But when it's bad, we point the finger at the head. That's why I say thank you so much. You're working as a collective. Let me start by following Honorable Swart as he took some of my notes. I thought maybe when he was passing here, he was sort of peeping in my notes. Nobody knows. By commending NPA for the achievements and highlights you, which are appearing in the report for the year under review. You know, you are, as he has alluded to, you are working under very, very pressing situation with financial constraints. But despite all odds, you managed to, if it was in a very, in an academic situation, I'll be saying you obtained cum laude. Yes, because anything above 75% is cum laude. Well done. On page 50, there are very few concerns. On page 53 of 2017, I think you heard, no? The previous one. No, not that one. This one. You don't have. Yeah? Yes. Oh, yeah, somehow. There is a where you allude to the fact that 77% of us...
Sorry, Honorable, if Honorable Mutapo could please just repeat the page number.
53. Yeah. 53. The one, this one you don't have. It's Implementation of Criminal Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act. I'm not sure why it's written like this. But the statement which appears in here is referred to in your annual report, whereby you are saying 77% of adults and 80% of children reported have received consultation by the prosecutor before they testified. But there are concerns. Other witnesses said that they saw the prosecutor for the first time when they were in court. So any comment on that? And again, the decline in conviction rate in violent process is a cause for concern. Declined by 18.1%, which is 18%, is a cause for concern, DPP. Again, a decline of 33.5% noted in number of Schedule 3 diversions. What informed that? And then again, a concern in terms of directors of public prosecutions in Polokwane and Mpumalanga in relation to the issue of personnel. So, fortunately, Honorable Swart has
touch on that. Let me leave it for now. A very serious concern. People, especially from rural areas, far-flung rural areas, travel. Let me give you an example of Bochum, Limpopo, where I come from. Leave Nabarana, Bochum, around 4 a.m. to go to Polokwane High Court. And then for only those very few hours. Are we not sort of disadvantaging our people in this regard? The declining of hours. Only three hours, 16 minutes previously, now it's 3 hours, 13 minutes. Even if it was, I think 4 to 5 hours is something, but 3 hours, 13 minutes, and they may be told to come back the following day or next month. It's very costly, especially for the indigent from rural areas. So also that, why I'm saying this, because you see, I know you may say that it's not within your control, but as the NDPP, I'm aware you're sitting in a National Enhancement Efficiency Committee. When we're saying NEC, I could see my colleague here was thinking of something else, isn't it? So you are referring to NEEC, Enhancement Efficiency Committee. So sometimes, are you not, such issues like the backlogs and other related issues, I was of the view that these are some of the things which you as the head of the institution will raise in this NECC, in such committee. Same will apply to the Provincial Director of Public Prosecution in PEECs. Yes. And then the vacancies, also very, very critical. Mm. That's why I would like to follow on what Honorable Salt has said by saying that, how best do you think you can help? I remember when you came in September, we're more than prepared to intervene, because we know as the NPA there is light at the end of the tunnel. What we are doing is highly appreciated by the public there outside and us as the portfolio committee which oversees. So please urgently reprioritize and tell us what then from now. And then I'm also concerned about the missing persons task team. There is this case of Nokuthula Simelane and other missing persons. Please update us on that. And the perennial challenges which the NPA is facing. I've seen the four which were tabled here, placing cases on the court rolls, implementation of pre-trial hearings, utilization of court hours, case flow management, and efficiency enhancement issues. Any update on that? And then update on PLASA. You remember in July 2017 you said something on a decision which is to be taken come end of July. Any update? Okay. Yeah. And then progress with the establishment of National Prosecuting Authority Academy. And then I think we should also, although we didn't mention the commendation I referred to, the on program, for your program, the audit opinion, very much promising. Thank you so much. And again, the achievement rates, regional courts, the high court, and then inspiring increase of 16.7% of number of persons convicted of corruption where the cases involved more than 5 million. That is very commendable indeed. It shows really that as a NPA, you are really committed to see to it that corruption doesn't pay, and you make sure that in terms of Vision 2030, which is a national development plan, all people, all South Africans live in peace and without any fear. So, Chairperson, okay, on also comment on high-profile cases, page 36 and 39 of that book. 39 of that book, highly commendable. The rhino poaching cases, environmental cases, and particularly criminal cases around the Dust Life gangs in, where is it, Eastern Cape, no? Yes, in Eastern Cape. That is highly commendable because this were for a very long time dealing with the issues emanating from, you said, somewhere around 1950. It's very, very, very complex. And again, on the coming back to vacancy rate, on very complex commercial cases, it appears you didn't do so well. Maybe you may unpack to this committee as a collective, how best can we then intervene in terms of making sure that you achieve, as you have achieved so excellently in Asset Forfeiture Unit. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Honorable Motapo, Honorable Matthias.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Look, there's the performance of the Directorate for Public Prosecution is commendable indeed. I want to join my colleagues in expressing such words of appreciation to the work done for the period under review. However, let me start with the general and perhaps wrap off with the specific. And in doing so, reserve the detail for some other time. Advocate Abrams, in his opening remarks, made a point which I find very disturbing, that, and I would want to quote, corrupt public representatives cannot be corrupt on their own, close quote. If that statement is left in that way, unqualified, it leaves many with many interpretations. I wish there could be a time when that would be qualified, because it leaves many with so many interpretations, and it can as well be interpreted as a call to citizens to adapt to the pervasive culture of corruption and impunity, wherein which leaders who are in both corporate as well as in political and bureaucratic offices, who lack ethical conduct, who behaves in the manner that promotes a culture of corruption, are left free to continue committing corruption because they don't commit corruption on their own. And this will sound like a justification for them to continue as such. I hope that you will find time to correct that. Corruption thrives in a culture of impunity, and we should not be seen to be contributing in promoting a culture of impunity. We ought to put a stop to the culture of impunity in this country and give no excuse for any unethical and corrupt conduct by whosoever involved in the commissioning of corruption. Ethical leadership and public accountability and good governance should be central to the work that we do. And the National Directorate of Public Prosecution, amongst many law enforcement organs of the state, should be seen
to be leading the offensives against corruption in promotion of ethical public accountability and good leadership. As we speak today, Kenya is grappling with the evils of the former president, the late president, Daniel Arap Moi. And it has not succeeded to get out of the bottomless of the dark pit of corruption because of the evil conduct of a leader who came and gone. And Kenya today is struggling with that. How I wish that South Africa will never find itself in that situation 10, 15 years late. We have to fight any forms of state clientelism manifesting itself through dispensation of political patronage. And you need to cut the umbilical cord from whichever direction that it flows from. The dispensing of patronage which promotes state clientelism and any forms of predatory behavior in the state. I thought I need to make those few remarks just as a precursor of some few points that I wanted to make. Look, earlier on yesterday we had a presentation from the Office of the Auditor General, for which the report indicates that the National Directorate of Public Prosecution, unlike the department itself, is not digressing into the negative in terms of its audit report performance, but is progressing positively, which is a good positive development, which must be commendable. Must be commented, as we have initially said. However, I would want to, as we also raised with the department earlier today, that we are concerned about convictions at the level of offences committed around sex, what is called sexual offences. We are very much concerned about that. And we have raised with the department earlier on that we need in their next appearance to report on measures taken to develop what we refer to as national registry on sex offenders. We need to know these guys wherever they are, and we need to see real conviction taking place against sex offenders. How we wish that in your next appearance you must be able to distinguish between macro and micro convictions. We need to see the big guys being prosecuted, and also want to see the small guys being prosecuted, wherever they are. So it would be good if you do that distinction of the rate of convictions at macro as well as micro level of the guys that are involved in the commissioning of crime and corruption. Lastly, is about the report which we have attached here on misconduct and disciplinary outcomes. It's good that you are able to report cases of misconduct and action taken against those who contravened your code of conduct, and how we wish that this pattern must be sustained, and any semblance of rot within the Directorate of Public Prosecution must be taken out. And lastly, Madam Chair, just as a word of comment, that the presentation is detailed, and let me say that I hope that in the next appearance of the Directorate of National Prosecution. So the standard will be maintained, and we'll see more progress of the work that they are doing, and ensure that as they do their work, the sovereignty of the country is not sold, is not given, it's not thrown to the dogs, by ensuring that they maintain their oath in ensuring that as they discharge and administer justice and prosecute that those who are found on the wrong side of the law, they do so without any fear or any favor. And we hope to see many heads rolling. The environment through which within which they operate is inspiring. The office of the Chief Justice is a guarantor, and the Constitutional Court is a guarantor that assures the National Director of Public Prosecution that he can also walk in that direction without any fear of contradiction, without any fear of favor from whosoever. And the South African public is also getting vigilant to hold public representatives accountable, and should this Directorate of Public Prosecution march in vanguard in that direction, history will judge it very kindly. But should it not do so, history will judge it very, very harshly. I hope that these words are words of encouragement on them to march in vanguard in the restoration of the sovereignty of the Republic.
Thank you, Honorable Matthias, Honorable Mpumlana.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much. I want to repeat what the other people have said, like a broken record, that you have done very good, very well. I think everybody almost say thank you. I, however, have 1, 2, 3 points. There is a feeling that has been there in South Africa from the people, from particularly the black people generally, that justice is for the rich people. And for white people. I mean, this has been like that for a long time. I remember certain cases of in Tata, one white lady was robbed of a car, and the helicopter came from East London, and the car was found 30 kilometers away, immediately within less than an hour, and the prosecution went there. Another case of foreigners, I think they were from New Zealand, that were raped in Lusikisiki. 10 helicopters came from Durban and went and hunted those boys down, and they got them. Within less than 2 weeks, they went straight to the High Court and were given 25 years immediately. And when a lot of people have been raped and nothing happened, I would like just to sensitize you on that and say you need to change the attitude and be seen to be doing that. There is this is general. This is not your making. This is general attitude. Association of European with value and African with that. You know, the attitude generally of the courts as well. There is a reliance by prosecutors on the police and their statements. When I... In most cases that I
used to organized practice, in particularly in violent crimes like in murder. I would go there. I would not listen to the attorney or to the witness. I would go straight to the scene of crime and know exactly what's happening. So when I'm talking in court, I say, no. The distance between there is not that much. How would you do that? You know, the prosecutor doesn't know. He has not been there. He has no idea what's going on. He relies on what is written on the paper. So there is very little, there needs to be some kind of more relationship between the prosecution and the police so that they are working together as a team, and the policeman understands that this statement that he has taken is, if it just make sure that it is correct, rather than just take the statement as it is and go prosecute on it, because the cases are thrown out. Secondly, there is there's a crime that is affecting a number of people, particularly the elderly people. They are poor, and they can't make ends meet. And therefore, they are robbed by these people called machonisas. And very little prosecution is done as far as that is concerned. Every 15th, 25th, and 30th of each month, you can go and watch it yourself everywhere. You'll find they will having their bank cards, including those social... Yes. The elderly people, they are not legally not allowed to do so. And yet nobody cares for their plight. I would request that more arrests, and also I would like you to show the statistics of the prosecution, success of prosecution on that. And I think it is important to have some kind of a training of not only prosecutors but as well as police in certain about that type of crime. Also including, there are certain areas in the rural areas, particularly next to the sea, in the so-called wild coast, where abalone, other type of fish that are being stolen by quite a number of people. Actually, there is also a ship that is always outside Coffee Bay, standing somewhere there, a Chinese ship or something. I'm not saying go and arrest them, but I'm saying that the prosecutors as well as the police should be made aware of various crimes that excludes the normal police work that they say they want to see somebody being bitten or stolen or something like that. They should also know other types of crime. And as I said, the emphasis mainly on the working together with the police. Before I give the last one, I want to emphasize that what can we do? Is there anything that we can do to assist as far as your budget is concerned, to assist adjustment here and there? And please come up with that so that if there is any way that we can make some adjustment, as Honorable Swart has said. The other one, I don't know. There was a TRC at some stage. And the TRC, there were people who didn't go to the TRC, were therefore not, did not get the amnesty. Are those cases rotting? Is there a way of checking? Few cases were brought in. I think TRC was like a staged thing more than anything else. But anyway, one would like to know if there is any move towards that. we try to be very kind and said, let people come and we forgive them. But most of them didn't. And others who did not get this. But there seems no movement towards prosecution on that. Just want to find out that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Mfumlana. To once again thank the National Prosecuting Authority for the presentation, and to say that it's actually encouraging to see that the conviction rate on corporate theft is increasing. One of the crises that the country is actually experiencing, we really need to clamp down on these criminals. If you look at a lot of suburbs, they actually go without electricity for a long time because of the copper theft. And just recently, copper theft worth about 17 million was actually discovered in Ekurhuleni. It's unacceptable for South Africans to do business on what they steal from the state. We need to clamp down on such criminals. Also, the conviction rate on violent protest is problematic if it goes down, yes. We need to be sure that within the constitutional democracy, when the people of South Africa have got rights to protest, they need to understand that it must be peaceful protest. Half the confusion that you see in the country is about what's supposed to be peaceful protest. It actually turns out to be violent. People get hurt. People's stores get broken into. And people are stealing freely, being watched by the general public. We got to have a way of actually stopping this as South Africa or South Africans. Otherwise, we'll actually end up with a state of anarchy if we don't actually manage to deal with such situations decisively. You've indicated that you want to negotiate with the department to give you back independent, I'm saying in inverted commas, status, which is what used to be the situation before. And we had to take you back into the department because there were challenges, audit challenges. We are getting qualified. And let me actually also congratulate you for this unqualified audit on program number 4. So I don't know now whether you want to go back to the situation that was actually also qualifying you. Because there was this problem with the Auditor General's office, and this is why the department has had to actually be sent back. The prosecuting authority operations had to be referred back to the department. Just bear that in mind as you are thinking along these lines. It will be good to maybe in future manage to indicate just general statistics on the level of prosecution of corruption in state institutions, so that we can tell ourselves when you're sitting here that we have it under control, because corruption is a menace to all South Africans. Where you find that just going into a state, a government institution over one of the counters, then people have got to be expected to be doing favors before they can be provided with a service. If that happens to South Africa, we're not going to develop the pace or rate of development that South Africa wishes to see this country advancing. So it will be good for your kind of reports to manage to indicate as to how many of these people in government institutions that are actually using the desk that has created the job for them to utilize it for corruption. And of course, we're not actually just saying that corruption is in state institutions only. Because indeed, the private sector also, or just private individuals also participate in corrupt activities like this. If it's possible for you to manage to actually extend it to that level, it will be very important. Because we can only thrive as a country if we manage to actually get rid of corruption. I don't seem to have a feel of your statistics when it comes to gender-based violence. And we are a country that's really grappling with the whole issue of gender-based violence, especially killings and murders of young women. If you look at, for example, just some of the names like Garabo that we just buried, and then some other young women whose names I cannot remember. Beautiful young women at the peak of their lives getting murdered. We have to have a way of stopping it. To allow them, yes, to give them their right to life so that they can be in the position to live the life that they wanted unhindered or not murdered, like the rate at which this is taking place. So in future, if maybe your statistics can actually also manage to have this category of gender-based violence so that we can see how we are doing along those lines, if the cases are actually successfully prosecuted, and if not successfully prosecuted, what are the obstacles? I know, because you know your job is very difficult in the sense that we will want you to prosecute successfully, but you actually also depend on the investigation. But it's always important to understand and have a clear picture, because then it means we know as to how we can be in the position to then engage, for example, SAPS. And then also another area that requires your attention is remand detainees. Our correctional centers are overflowing, and part of it is, prosecution pace is slow. It might not only be you, of course, because it's a joint effort of the cluster, but you need to note it. And when you do report, it will be good for us to have an idea as to what effort are you actually putting into trying to help us to reduce the number of remand detainees in our correctional centers, because this is something that's really becoming too expensive for the country. I guess those are my comments. Okay, on page 17, if you are both looking at the figures, they don't seem to be balancing. We tried to do work it out, and we use the calculator, but the figures don't seem to be balancing. The 777-1696 dockets, which were received, and then there is 91687 dockets where prosecution was instituted, and then also you have dockets which were actually referred back to 253. When you do the calculation, it's not really balancing. Maybe you could actually just work it out and see if what we think is a problem here is indeed a problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Over to you, Advocate Abrams.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me at the outset thank the members of the committee for the very warm and kind remarks about our achievements over the last reporting period. Let me also thank this committee for their support and their wisdom, which has contributed greatly to us making significant progress in the challenges that we have and that we consistently strive to overcome, to improve a more, to provide a more efficient service to the citizenry of this country. We always welcome the engagement and contribution from this committee. This committee has an important role, and we welcome its oversight, responsibility over such a key institution such as the NPA. I'm going to answer as many of the questions as I possibly can, but I'm also going to refer questions to some of my colleagues. With regards to the first question by Honourable Horn in respect of the officers in Mpumalanga and Limpopo, and what assistance can be rendered, what have we done in that regard? Let me first start off by saying, before the Limpopo High Court was built, when the decision was made for the Limpopo High Court to be built, the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions in Pretoria, who was headed by Advocate Mzinyati, had established a satellite office by moving files and moving staff. So it's court files and office files were moved and court staff were relocated to Limpopo to facilitate the ease of when the court was to be proclaimed. We've done exactly the same in respect of Mpumalanga. So there is a satellite office in Mpumalanga. There are two deputy directors of public prosecutions that are currently there, while one has left and is an acting deputy director of public prosecution that is there. There's also senior state advocates, junior state advocate, but that is not enough. So more staff will have to go there. And with the remarcation of the boundaries, this will have an impact on the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions in both Johannesburg and Pretoria, the Northwest, the Northern Cape, and of course, ultimately, the Eastern Cape too. So we'll have to shift staff around under those circumstances because there'll be operational requirements. Now, one of the exercises that we've embarked upon, which I spoke about during my, you know, during my opening address and presentation, was how we started with the optimum utilization project within the head office, where professional staff that are in excess must go to where staff is needed and their expertise are required. And that's a process that we will, of course, roll out to the regions, and we'll probably issue a letter to the director, the directors of public prosecutions, the head of the asset forfeiture unit, and to special directors to start that process as soon as we get back, you know, from Cape Town. It's an urgency for us. By way of example, we can't have a situation where you have state advocates or senior state advocates sitting at DPP offices where the distribution of work is not equal and their expertise are needed in the lower courts where there are vacancies. They must go help out. That is the reality. We need to tighten the belts. And we need to look at how we could optimally utilize our resources. So we've done that to an extent, and we'll continue to do so. And of course, we're going to try and we're going to take people's personal circumstances into consideration. We'll engage with officials. We'll consult with them. We don't want a situation of chaos to exist, like we did in the initial instance at the VGM building, where we conducted a survey. And then we called the officials in and we spoke to them. and we told them why we had to do what we established and why we have to embark upon the exercise that we're embarking upon. It is necessary. So yes, with regards to Mpumalanga and Limpopo, there are staff shortfalls. We need additional staff there. we've identified positions that were advertised previously. I think there's 45 posts, and those posts are being filled. 46 are sold. 46 positions. Some of these relate to Limpopo, you know, and Mpumalanga as well. So we're looking how best and how fast we can fill critical vacancies. This is something we've taken up with National Treasury. I expect to have a meeting this coming week with the Director General of the Department of Treasury, where I intend to address, you know, our concerns. I had a telephonic discussion with him, and I said to him off the cuff, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, by how much we will, when we will overspend. I said to him, we need 250 million with immediate effect. Of course, we need much more. And that will become more clearer when I speak about other projects that we intend embarking upon. With regards to vacancies in the SCCU, Advocate Governor will talk a bit about that. That's critical. Maybe I can just touch on it. The SCCU is largely responsible for the management of investigations and the conducting of prosecutions of serious, fraud, financial mismanagement and economic crimes and corruption. If I'm going to appoint investigating directors, for example, many of the staff that come will come from the SCCU. By way of example, that are to fulfill specific responsibilities. So we will need more money for that, to give effect thereto. The fight against corruption, the question of the state of capture report. Yes, less than a month ago, I took the country into confidence as to what we are doing. These investigations are in progress. I know in respect of one of the legs, real significant progress has been made. Regrettably, I'm not going to take this committee into confidence and say which one of those legs it is. But in due course, this committee will see that work is being done. That's the best I can do today in respect of, you know, of the eight legs. Sorry, Honourable Horn, I can't tell you more at this stage. The Van Heerden matter in the Supreme Court of Appeal, I was deeply disturbed when I read the judgment. I immediately referred the matter to my team for investigation. I had a discussion with the Director of Public Prosecutions in the Western Cape, who had also taken the liberty of appointing somebody to look into it. I said to him, no, I want somebody independent and not somebody from his office to look into the matter. The matter is receiving attention. It's being investigated. Ironically, one of the prosecutors, and the prosecutor actually, committed the misstatement, is now a magistrate. My position was clear. I want the entire matter investigated, and I'm happy to write to the Magistrates Commission at the end of this investigation to inform the Magistrates Commission of the conduct of the individual concerned. I think it's necessary under these circumstances. So there is an investigation that's being conducted in respect of the matter. I think I read the judgment. The judgment was delivered, as you said, I think it was the 9th of September, somewhere around there, and it got to my attention 2 or 3 days later, and I read it immediately and gave instructions immediately in respect of the matter. The issue of the withdrawal rate in high courts, I'm going to ask Advocate Mzinyati to address that. Yes, matters should never get to the High Court and then be withdrawn. If they are withdrawn, it must be for reasons of witnesses being unavailable and the witnesses becoming unavailable, you know, after the matter has been transferred to the High Court. Either witnesses are killed or, you know, or witnesses, it should never be about evidential problems. It should largely be issues around witnesses. Of course, we're also not keen to accept withdrawal statements by complainants in such serious matters. But I'd like Advocate Mzinyati to address that issue, that issue with you. In respect of Advocate Mkhwebi and Advocate Jiba, I've recently been informed that no date, as recent as yesterday, that no date has yet been obtained by the Supreme Court of Appeal in respect of the appeal. The Mdluli matter, I'm pleased you asked about the Mdluli matter. I've written letters to various national commissioners, first to Ria Bayeha, then to General Pashlani, and then I've also had a discussion with the current, you know, acting national commissioner. Before General Pashlani stopped being the acting national commissioner of police, he had responded to my letters, to my communications. The issue is now with the head of crime intelligence, where the head of crime intelligence and the prosecuting team and investigator are supposed to sit and look at, you know, and look at the declassification of the documents. The matter was struck from the roll because documents had not been declassified. And, you know, the prosecutors and investigators knew about the matter, yet they persisted to continue with the matter without, you know, giving qualification to the elephant that existed in the investigation, which was, you know, the declassification of documentation. So I've got various correspondence that I've written. It's now culminated to a position where the acting national commissioner, as he was at the time, had issued a directive that there should be consultation. You know, they're all for the declassification of the documentation, and there should be a consultative process between the head of crime intelligence, you know, and the prosecutors and the investigator. So that's where we're at, quite frankly, so far as that matter is concerned. So we've kept to our commitment by engaging with the police at the highest level for the declassification of the documentation. With regards to the questions of the discrepancy, you know, in the figures in respect of the various matters raised, Advocate Mzinyati will respond to that. The issue of prosecutors not consulting with witnesses beforehand has been raised by, you know, by you as well, Honorable Tapo. We of course encourage and we strive for prosecutors to consult with witnesses before they start their trials. A prosecutor should never see a witness for the first time once he or she is in the witness dock. That's unacceptable practice. And if one looks at the court hours that are being utilized, or more correctly stated, that are being underutilized, then that's a situation that should never happen under any circumstances. We, of course, have victim impact statements. In this regard, most witnesses that are consulted, complete victim impact statements. We will look into the issue around prosecutors not consulting, with witness timelessly. It's an unacceptable practice, so we'll look into that. And thank you for bringing it to our attention. how many cases has the ACTD, you know, dealt with during this reporting period? I don't think we have those figures offhand. We will respond there to in writing. Yes.
Sorry, Madam Chair, before you go on, the first two questions are asked. Are you going to answer them or are you also going to respond in writing?
No, I said Advocate Mzinyati will respond to them. The court hours are decreasing. It's a massive concern for us. And that's something that really needs to be addressed. This is something that we address at various levels, you know, at a district level, at a regional level, at a provincial level, and of course at a national level in the various efficiency enhancement committee meetings. This is also one of the issues that we will be engaging with the police in our joint collaboration initiatives. Of course, we must accept, by virtue of the norms and standards, that the judiciary is responsible for placing court cases for trial, or deciding how many court cases are set down for trial on a daily basis. And that's something that has to be addressed, quite frankly. I didn't understand the question to be that the NPA is to blame, you know, for court hours decreasing. It's a general challenge in the criminal justice system, and the judiciary should explain this. They're responsible for placing matters on the court roll in terms of the norms and standards of the Office of the Chief Justice. The question around the SIU cases, we'll respond in writing. We don't have the statistics offhand. I'm pleased the issue was raised around the IPUD report earlier this year, where IPUD presented to Parliament. We had a meeting with IPUD shortly thereafter. We had a meeting a few weeks ago. We had a meeting with IPUD. The meeting was to discuss a number of cases, but more particularly joint initiatives and collaboration. It was supposed to be a high-level meeting. IPUD raised questions around cases. For us, it was supposed to be a high-level meeting to look at joint collaboration. At the outset, we raised this issue with IPUD as to the statistics that they presented, because statistics did not present how many cases were withdrawn. So we'll have to look into this and give you some sort of a written response there too, but we did take this up with IPUD immediately because it didn't reflect the correct position. The reality is that, in many of the IPUD matters, and police matters too, these matters are sent back for further investigation. So, of the cases that have been referred to the NPA, I can assure this committee that many of these matters were either withdrawn or declined to prosecute or referred back for further investigation. Those statistics were not reflected, and we made it clear that they should look at, when they present to Parliament, that these figures are correctly and the different categories are correctly portrayed to give a more complete picture. We've agreed to enter into a memorandum of understanding, as I said to this committee when I was last year. The memorandum of understanding will address some of these concerns insofar as joint collaboration between the NPA and IPUD. Yes, the salary issues between the discrepancies between senior state advocates and deputy directors, is a massive concern for us. We have addressed, I can't say we've addressed it because, we're almost at the final stages of addressing it. I have a scheduled meeting with the Minister of Justice next week. This is one of the issues on the agenda. We've created a framework, for a framework whereby we try to link the salaries of deputy directors to that of the national director. Now, as And maybe I should talk a little bit about that so it can make sense. As you know, the national director's salary cannot be less than that of a judge of the High Court. So Cabinet resolved at the inception of the NPA when Advocate Bulalani Nuka was appointed as the national director, that that salary will be capped at that stage at the level of a judge of the Supreme Court of Appeal. So all the perks that come with that, etc., you know, is attributed to a national director. Deputy national directors' salaries are capped at 10, not less than 85% of that of the national director, and directors of public prosecutions not less than 80%. So we've come up with a framework, and without disclosing what the percentage is, you know, that we link it to that of the national directors. So whenever the national director gets an increase or not, it affects everybody else. But not only do we want to link the deputy directors, we want to link every other prosecutor's salary to that. Because the challenge that as a result in the position that we find ourselves is because, you know, prosecutors, you know, are appointed in terms of a different section of the NPA Act, and deputy directors are appointed in terms of Section 15 of the NPA Act. So when the minister issues directives, this is the minister of the DPSA, issues directives on the salaries of prosecutors, there's a difference between that of prosecutors and then, of course, deputy directors appointed in terms of a different section of the NPA Act. So, which has resulted in senior state advocates who forward in the first category salary escalated to such a degree where they earn more than deputy directors. To avoid this anomaly from continuing and repeating itself, we think it's best that every prosecutor's salary is linked to that of the national directors. So if the national director gets an increase, everybody else does. It's the same percentage. If the national director doesn't get an increase, then nobody else gets an increase. If we don't adopt such an approach, we're going to have a massive problem. This cycle will continue. It will repeat itself 5 years from now or 10 years from now. But we'll be back to this very position, having to relook at the salaries of deputy directors of public prosecution. So that's what we're looking at, and that's something we're going to try and sell to the Minister of Justice, to persuade him, and of course for him then to persuade the Minister of the DPSA and Finance that this is the correct position to take, to avoid this position from repeating itself in future. So it's not a matter of us not having done anything. We've worked tirelessly to try and get the figures right, the percentages right. We also don't want to unjustly enrich people. We want to be fair to everybody in the process at the end of the day.
May I just ask you a follow-up on that while you're still on it? If this has been a position for some time now, do you have a time frame on this solution?
I have a meeting scheduled next week with the Minister of Justice where an array of different issues impacting on the NPA, of course, the Minister has final responsibility over the NPA in terms of the impact on the Constitution. This is one of those issues that I endeavour to discuss with you during the course of next week. To say to you that we will finalise the process next week, I cannot give that undertaking. The Minister may not be persuaded. Then I've got to go back to the drawing board with my team. Of course, I will then communicate to the affected parties by sending out some sort of an internal communication so that everybody knows where we're at insofar as the process.
Just to say that maybe the answers are not going to lie in this portfolio committee, because it's a matter that has got to do with public service, I guess, commission. So through the minister, maybe you need to direct that matter then, and you can come and let us know of the outcome.
Thank you, Chairperson. The aspirant prosecutors program, of course, you know, we had to terminate that over the last 2 years for a number of reasons which I've advanced to this committee, you know, during previous briefings, and which I don't think is necessary to repeat. What we have created is a structure called the National Prosecuting Authority Academy. If memory serves me correct, I did speak about it during my last visit here in, here in September, less than a month ago. I'm actually meeting with the head of that structure this Friday, where we will discuss. We have had engagements, documents have been submitted to me. We're looking at giving effect to the structure with effect from the 1st. From the 1st of April, we'll be looking at having a new intake of aspirant prosecutors, aspirants into the program. So the head of this academy will not only be responsible for the aspirants program, but also for the for all other training within the institution. So we'll have various legs, or sub-programs that require training under the National Prosecuting Authority Academy. This will include both professional and non-professional staff. We think it's necessary to have the training under all the training under one roof for the interest of uniformity to take the institution forward. I'm really confident with it, with the head of the structure. He comes with vast experience. His heart and his mind is in the right place. I'm really confident, of the successes that will come out of this. We must look at this as a seed that's been planted, and ultimately a massive oak tree will grow from this. This is the future of the NPA. I'm very confident of that. The issue of Section 28 in investigations, I have had engagements with the head of the Hawks. I've consulted with him. There's nothing wrong with that. I consulted with the head of the Hawks on issues around investigating directives. I've consulted with my team in the NPA, and we've taken a position, and that position will come to the fore, in the next few days. I've given specific instructions. So I'm reluctant to respond directly to you at this stage, but the decisions that I've taken in this regard, will come to the fore over the next few days or so. The outer report, I cannot remember when I received the outer report. The outer report was immediately referred to the head of the SECU. It was also referred to the head of the Hawks by outer. So the head of the SECU is working, well, not the head of the SECU, the SECU has assigned prosecutors who are working with the Hawks in respect of the matter. If memory serves me correct, I think it's part of the whole, of the various legs of the state of capture investigations that's taking place. It was just incorporated into all of that. So it's not something on its own. It's not something separate. It's part of all of that. Honorable Swart, your question in respect of the SECU, again, Advocate Govender, Marlon Govender will speak a bit about that. The issue of prosecutor guided investigations is multifold. Firstly, it actually starts, and I'm speaking generally, not just in the SECU. It starts with a phone call by an investigating officer to a prosecutor. Whether that prosecutor is a prosecutor, in the lower court, in the regional court, in the high court, whether he or she is a control prosecutor, a senior public prosecutor, a chief prosecutor, a state advocate, a senior state advocate, or a deputy director of public prosecutions, it can start with something small like that, just a telephone call. It also starts when a docket arrives at a magistrate's court or at any of the DPP offices, and that docket is perused and guidance is given as to what investigations are required. That's separate to your projects that are being run, you know, through the SCCU or specialist unit, where there are project plans in place. So there are different processes around prosecutor-guided investigations, but it's a strict methodology, you know, that found its roots in the SCCU and the PCLU, and these are units that largely use it. So too do the organized crime structures use it. It's a necessary functionary to advance the administration of justice. Of course, we cannot answer why, you know, certain members of the DPCI were removed or certain structures had been realigned, you know, but we can engage with the police during our bilateral engagements to understand, you know, and of course to impress upon them where we feel assistance is required and lacunas had in fact been created. Our corruption laws, in respect of your question around the state of capture and the issue of extradition, and the fact that there is no treaty between ourselves and the UAE. Let me at the outset say, our corruption laws provide for extraterritorial jurisdiction. I think your challenge is that it doesn't help us much in the absence of any, you know, bilateral, you know, extradition treaty. We don't need a treaty to extradite anybody from anywhere in the world. It does help, it does assist, but we have an extradition act, and of course there's also processes around comity, you know, etc. So international law is broad enough to allow us to apply for extradition of the individuals anywhere in the world. They could, I mean, if people find themselves or suspects in matters, accused, we decide we're going to prosecute people, and they find themselves in countries where there's no extradition treaty or agreement in place, nothing prevents us from utilizing our domestic extradition act. Similarly, nothing prevents us from red flagging people with Interpol, which prevents them from traveling anywhere else in the world, and it places responsibility on those countries to effect arrest on individuals, and of course we can then extradite individuals from whichever country they find themselves in, should they be arrested in that particular country. So there are mechanisms in place to give effect thereto. And you're quite correct, an example you use of the Bobrov matter. Of course, that was by cooperation between South Africa and the Israelis. Of course, there's also cooperation between South Africa and the Australian authorities and a number of other authorities. Ironically, that's a matter that your colleague... you know, Honorable Breitenbach dealt with before, when she was still at the NPA. The Bobrov matter. Yeah, confusing the Bobrov. It was a Tenenbaum matter. To the Tenenbaum matter. See, I do make mistakes. let me speak a bit about and respond to Honorable Motapo's questions. Advocate Zinyati will respond to the questions based on the percentages of prosecutors seeing witnesses for the first time. I did speak about it earlier on. Of course, we strive for 100%. You know, we always strive for that. But it's an issue that we are going to look into and address. So we're very pleased that this committee has brought it to our attention. Advocate Zaniati will speak about the decline in the diversions. We've addressed the issue of Limpopo and Mpumalanga. I understand the challenges faced by witnesses having to travel from afar. Of course, it depends in which forum, you know, they have to appear as witnesses, whether it's a district court, which ordinarily should be in closer proximity, you know, to where they live, and a regional court, which, you know, may still be close, but or possibly a little bit further, and then of course the High Court. But High Courts also sit as circuit courts to allow for access to justice. Regional courts also sit ad hocly, at certain places. It all depends, you know, on the specifics of that particular jurisdiction. So, this is something, of course, if I can have more information about the challenges of that particular area, Honorable Mutombo, I can, of course, engage with the Department of Justice on that to see how we can enhance access to justice to that particular community. Again, issues of jurisdictional boundaries and provincial boundaries. Of course, some of that has political ramifications and requires, political input. And I would not want to speak about that in this engagement. But I do accept the costs effect to the indigent. But of course, witness fees and transport fees are provided for, by the Department of Justice to witnesses who have to travel. Sometimes investigating officers assist by bringing witnesses to court. Those witnesses, of course, still get witness fees. So there are mechanisms to overcome some of these challenges. Issues such as backlogs, these are issues that we do discuss at various levels. And of course, we have screening processes in place, screening mechanisms in place in the NPA to address the issues of backlogs. These screening processes has resulted in some of the successes that we've reported on, which you've commended us on. So our screening processes are working to give effect to backlog matters. We will continue to reinvent ourselves and see what we need to do things better, to improve and bring down the backlog rate, and work closely with our stakeholders in this regard. The question has been asked, how can you help us with regards to critical vacancies? We need your support to obtain more funds. You heard me speak about just off the cuff of about 250 million that we need immediately. But Dr. Ramayiti will probably tell you we need much more. And maybe he can speak a bit about that later on. If we are going to successfully fight the scourge of corruption, scourge of organized crimes and all organized crime in all its forms and manifestations, and if we want to come back a year from now and report back to this committee, we want to do better. And if we want to do better, we're going to need the resources to improve. missing persons task team is doing some really good work. They forward in a priority crime investigation unit. You raise the issue of Nokutula Samalani and, you know, and other TRC cases and older missing persons cases. The Nokutula Samalani matter, we of course have decided that there must be a prosecution. So I think memory serves because there's four policemen that we've decided should be prosecuted. You know, they had challenges with regards to legal costs. They wanted the Ministry of Police to pay for their legal costs because the alleged crime was committed whilst there were still policemen. I'm not in a position to comment at what stage that process is, you know, with the police to get the police to, you know, to pay for their legal costs. But that did hold up the matter somewhat. And hopefully we'll get a date soon for this trial to proceed. You'd recall that we made some critical decisions around TRC matters. The first was that Nokutula, the perpetrators in the Nokutula Samalani matter must be prosecuted. I reviewed the matter myself, and I decided there must be a prosecution. Similarly, the Ahmed Timo matter, we decided that there must be an inquest in respect of the matter, a formal inquest. And we're very happy with the way proceedings went, you know, in respect of the Ahmed Timo matter. There's another matter that we're currently considering. This is the Neil Agut matter. And I think the PCLU is, will obviously announce their decision in due course, but they're going to consult with me on the matter. They're going to consult with Advocate Mzinyati. They're going to consult with me. They've not consulted with Advocate Mzinyati as yet as to what, you know, their decision is. And the National Director in TRC matters has to give final authorization as to whether either an inquest must be held, a prosecution must ensue, or there must be or that there's a decline to prosecute in respect of the matter. There are a number of other TRC cases that are under consideration. We'll have the team brief us, and when I appear in a quarter's time, hopefully before this committee, I'm optimistic to do so. I think it's important I report here quarterly on topical issues and on the performance of the unit during the quarter. I probably would be in a position to speak more about the status of TRC matters, as well as more about the work of the Missing Persons Task Team. Because I think it's important that I give you facts and figures, and I don't have those facts and figures before me in respect of both the TRC matters and the Missing Persons Task Team matters. With regards to PRASA, we never made an undertaking that there'll be a decision, you know, by July, and we said that much at our previous engagement with the committee. In fact, we had at that stage received the prosecuting team that's providing guidance in the investigation had received over 20 Lever Arch files. 63, I'm told. At that stage, it only received 63 Lever Arch files in the PRASA matter. So we could never have been in a position in July to announce a decision around the matter. And I think I've addressed this during our last appearance before the committee as well. I've spoken about the NPA Academy. Governor will speak about the SECU vacancies. I want to deal with the issue raised by Honourable Matthias. What I said was the following. Firstly, I agree with you that corrupt officials, even persons in the private sector Sadaka rather. It must be brought to book. It doesn't matter what your standing or walk in life is. You must be brought to book. I agree completely with you on that. But what I said was the following, and I put it in context. I said, remember, I first spoke about the Hong Kong example of the journey Hong Kong had walked of 40 years. We don't have 40 years. We cannot afford 40 years. We need to deal with our issues now. We need to address the scourge of corruption now. I then went on to say, because they adopted a whole of societal approach, and I quote, remember the many government officials accused of corruption cannot be corrupt on their own. Private individuals and entities are equally culpable. There must be accountability at all levels, both in the private sector and government. So that statement was not alone and should never be read on its own in isolation. The point that we want to make is that every person responsible for corruption, whether you're in government or outside of government, must be brought to book. And that's the point that we try to make. We, of course, will look into the issue of micro and macro convictions. I think it's important to distinguish between the big fish and the little fish, because that would give an indication of how serious government is in the fight against corruption. It just sends it the wrong message, you know, if the little fish are prosecuted and the big fish get away with it. That's unacceptable, and that's something that of course has to be addressed, and we're happy to come back and to say to this committee, you know, what we have done, what we are doing. Again, let me just be mindful that you know, we will be careful not to convict people in the court of public opinion. You spoke about us dealing with corruption and disciplining our own people. In fact, a few days ago, you know, a prosecutor was convicted of corruption in Johannesburg and sentenced to jail to serve a period of 10 years imprisonment, of which three years of that was suspended. But if we prosecute on our own, we definitely will prosecute other people too. I've noted the issue of the feeling that black people in particular feel that justice is for the rich and for white people. And, of course, that's a message that we at the NPA do not stand for. You know, everyone's equal before the law. The Constitution says so, and it's a value that we espouse to. And we'd never want to give that perception, no matter where we find ourselves as prosecutors. So we will do our level best to ensure that perception is never attributed to the NPA. Advocate Govender will, you know, will look into the issue of the crimes that affect the elderly, where they are robbed, you know, at payday on the 15th and the end of every month. I did hear a whisper that these are matters dealt with by the SECU, so you know, she'll speak a bit about that. And of course, you know, if she doesn't have anything to talk about, you know, we can look into these and come back and report to this committee as to what initiatives we've undertaken to address this. But we're very pleased that you brought this to our attention, because we regard the elderly, you know, as part of the vulnerable group. I think the ship has sailed. The ship at Coffee Bay. I think after you spoke, it sailed. Thank you for alluding us there too. And of course, you know, we'll engage with our stakeholders. I know there are various operations that are run to eradicate, you know, crimes of that particular nature. So we'll look into it. Dr. Maiti will speak more about, you know, what you can do to assist us. I've spoken, addressed the issue of TRC matters. And then we've noted the comments made by the chairperson, and we definitely will take that into consideration going forward, as well as the issues around statistics. And we welcome the comments that have been made, and we will address the issues concerned. And thank you so much. I'm going to hand over to my colleagues then to speak, you know, on the issues as they were raised and as identified who would speak to what issues. And once they have concluded, then I will just close and just thank the committee once again. Thank you. So I'll hand over to firstly to Marlene Govender, and then to Advocate Bonkile Mzinyati, and then to Dr. Ramaiti, and then I'll then conclude. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I think the two issues that are tied up together was the issues of the impact of the restructuring of the Hawks, as well as the vacancies, and that impact on the conviction rate and the rate of finalization of cases, because that obviously is tied up to our performance. Firstly, I want to say that when the SEC was started, it was started with us working very closely with the commercial crime unit, who were seized with dealing with mainly the low and the medium complexity commercial crime cases, with the DSO dealing with the more complex matters. The DPCI then resulted in those more complex matters that the DSO traditionally dealt with now being dealt with by themselves. The DPCI's case intake criteria is such, as a result of the restructuring, that they focus on these more complex, serious matters. They have a case selection criteria, and if a case does not fall within such case selection criteria, it's referred through to the general detectives. This has meant that a major amount of work that does not qualify as being project-driven cases or major case investigations or regarded by the DPCI as being priority crimes, that those cases then normally, which are low and medium complexity cases, now are dealt with at detective station level. So since 2009, coming into our environment has been decreasing year on year from the DPCI. The concomitant effect of this is that these cases, because of their complexity, normally take more time to investigate. So you've got a longer turnaround time in terms of the investigations. You've also got that once these cases get onto the court roll, that they take longer to finalize. These cases also, we find, end up being highly litigated upon. And in particular, we are able to show that in terms of the percentage of the cases that are backlog, we've had a significant increase since 2009, and currently about 55% of the cases on the SECU court roll are in fact backlog cases.
My apologies for interrupting you. Sorry. Most of us are going to use public transport, the buses, so it's now 10 to 5. Can we wrap up within 10 minutes? Is it possible, Chair?
or
it's okay. And then for the areas that you have not had an opportunity of responding to, we can actually do it in writing.
Sure.
So
let me.
Is that are we agree?
Yes.
On.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, you know, Chairperson. We'll respond in writing on the issues that Advocate Govind and Advocate Zinyati need to speak on further. I just think it's critical that Dr. Ramayiti speaks about the budget issues. I think that's very, very important. And I think just to conclude by saying, we've had no audit qualification in 2010, 2011, 2012. We've had a clean audit in 2012, 13, and 13, 14. So we've consistently done well. So the issue of us not having clean audits, that's an issue of during the DSO days. So we're very confident with the team that we have the requisite expertise so far as our financial independence is concerned.
Thank you, Chairperson. The big question, what is it that we would need immediately? Okay. Thank you. I'm actually at the same time trying to talk through the microphone. But we have previously given an indication of what we need immediately, and the first one was the current personnel. In other words, in order to be able to pay the warm bodies that we currently have for 2017-2018, we need 70 million rands. And then for the aspirant prosecutors, which, as the NDPP has said, we intend to start with at the beginning of the next financial year, we need at least 27.2 million rands. And then for Polokwane and Mpumalanga, we need 35.8 million, and that totals 233 million rands. But that is not the end, because besides the problem with the warm bodies that we have other critical vacant posts that we have identified that need to be filled, and these are 239 posts. He has already spoken about the previous 46 that we have now just finalized. So we have done the approvals of the appointments. But then now we have to go to the next stage of addressing the 239 vacant posts. And for that, we need 135 million rands, over and above the 133 million rands that we have mentioned. And then there are presidential appointments that have to be made. There is, for example, special director in the Office of the National Director. There's also the position of a special director in AFU, and I think there are also directors of public prosecutions that have to be appointed. It's five posts all in all, and that totals to 10.4 million rands. And then there's a new proposed specialized unit to deal mainly with organized crime, and we're looking at about 14 posts, and that totals 12.2 million rands. So all in all, in total, it amounts to 291 million rands. But then honourable members must bear in mind that is only in the first year. So that is 291 million for the first year, and then 475 going into the second year, and then 518 going into the third year, so that it covers the MTEF period. So in total, over the MTEF period, what we're looking at is an additional 1.284 billion.
Is
So maybe we need that in writing.
Yeah. I think it will be important to get that in writing. And then you break down the amounts. I don't know, when you say we have 239 vacancies, how did you determine the vacancies? Why are they not in the current vote if they are approved vacancies? That's what you will actually put in the report. Put it in the report so that you make a breakdown of everything, including all these other amounts that you've actually indicated. But make it something that is doable. Because if you're going to have this E&E also that actually rockets, you are saying to us, you're actually coming with something that is risky.
Okay, can I also
prioritize?
Maybe just in conclusion on this. I'm not predicting, but my guess, and then that's just a wild guess. My guess is the need is going to increase. I've raised this with the NDPP. You have mentioned some of these cases that there's a push for us to do, for example, the state of capture report. Now, those are complex cases, and I can tell you that they are going to require even more resources. So our management. Our management. I'm just giving a warning, because I think I have a duty to provide that warning, to create that scenario. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. And then we'd like to have that information
before Friday next week, ne? Okay. Is it possible?
Yes.
Okay. In conclusion, 1.5 minutes. NDPP.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Chairperson. I don't need so much time. I just want to thank this committee for its support and for the really cordial, professional manner in which it engages with us and for its guidance. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to working closely with this committee. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you so much. Anything, Chair?
Thank you, Acting Chair.
40 seconds.
I think everything is fine.
Okay,
and let me thank the National Prosecuting Authority once more for coming to present before us.
So tomorrow we are meeting at 9:30, Old Assembly Chamber. Old Assembly. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. 9:30, Old Assembly.
Dr. Ramaid.
This is Dr. Lima.
Eh?
Thank you so much.
I hope you didn't whisper any secrets here.
Yep.